This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. After creating the HBO series 6 Feet Under, about a family that runs a funeral home and is steeped in death, Alan Ball created a new HBO series about the undead. True Blood is about vampires who've returned from the grave and live on a newly developed synthetic blood called True Blood. Their presence is so new, no one knows what to make of them. Some people find them sexy, many fear them, and some are just curious. The vampires have formed their own lobbying group, which is pushing for passage of a Vampire Rights Act. In this scene, one of the vampires is trying to convince a skeptical Bill Maher that the vampire should have the same rights as any other American.
We're citizens. We pay taxes. We deserve basic civil rights just like everyone else.
Yeah, but, I mean, come on. Doesn't your race have a rather sordid history of exploiting and feeding off innocent people for centuries?
3 points. Number one, show me documentation. Doesn't exist. Number two, doesn't your race have a history of exploitation? We never owned slaves, Bill, or detonated nuclear weapons. And most importantly, point number three, now that the Japanese have perfected synthetic blood, which satisfies all of our nutritional needs, there is no reason for anyone to fear us.
True Blood is based on Charlaine Harris's Southern Vampire series of novels. The second season of True Blood premieres June 14th, and the DVD of the first season will be out later this month. Alan Ball also directed the movie Towelhead and won an Oscar for his screenplay of American Beauty. Terry spoke to Alan Ball last fall when the first season of True Blood premiered.
Alan Ball, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with some of the basic plot points for True Blood. Why have the vampires come out of their coffins and returned?
The vampires have made their presence known to humans because there has been a development of synthetic blood by a Japanese biotech firm for medical purposes, which the vampires claim satisfies all their nutritional requirements. And so there's no reason for humans to fear them. And they've put together a lobbying organization, and they're lobbying for equal rights. And ultimately, what is at the root of everything, which is not very clear at this point in the show, is they want ownership. They want to be able to own things. And whether or not vampires can actually survive on True Blood alone is also something we just sort of have to take their word for. Although in this world, there are plenty of people who are willing to let vampires feed on them.
Yeah, it's because it's kind of a kick for people. It's like, wow, they're vampires.
It's a kick. It usually is accompanied by sex. And apparently vampires are pretty good at sex.
Yeah, and where does that come from? Where does that part of the lore come from?
I wondered about that, and I think, certainly if you've been around 100 years, you have time to perfect your technique. But I also think, and part of the way we're playing vampires and the supernatural in general, is that it's not something that exists outside of nature. It's actually a deeper, more primal manifestation of nature, so deep and primal sometimes that we as humans don't even have the perception to see it or feel it.
You know, it's funny, in the original Bram Stoker Dracula novel, the novel seems to be so much about sexual fear, you know, sexual attraction and sexual fear. And it's it's almost like a metaphor for sexually transmitted disease.
Mm. Well, I think it certainly took on that characteristic during the AIDS, once the AIDS epidemic hit. But it's also just a metaphor for sex. You know, someone is penetrated, bodily fluids are exchanged. There is a sort of surrender. So it's a pretty potent, no pun intended, metaphor for just sex in and of itself, I think, and has been for ever since Bram Stoker's Dracula.
And in your series, True Blood, there's a big connection between sex and danger. And there are several characters in it who really like sex and danger combined.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it gets more dangerous than they expected. But why was that interesting for you two, exploring that connection that exists for some people?
I don't really know. I think it was just a visceral thing. I think when I started reading the books, they had a sort of pulpy sensibility. Everything was heightened, and each chapter ended with a cliffhanger, and and there was there's a big body count, and danger lurks around every corner, as does romance, as does finding someone you love or meeting your maker in, however you choose to interpret that. And when I pitched it to HBO for the first time, I said, this is popcorn television. You know, this is a popcorn TV show.
What else did you tell them?
Well, they asked me, well, what is the show about? And I had no answer, but being, the Hollywood person that I have become in some ways, unfortunately, over the years, I just started talking and hoped that something would come out of my mouth that sounded vaguely coherent. I think I talked about the fears that we project onto any minority group that is misunderstood or feared. And then I said, at the heart of it, though, it is a show about the terrors of intimacy. And I heard myself say that, and I thought, well, that sounds pretty good. And actually, the more that I look at it, I can sort of see that it is, in a sense, about the terrors of intimacy, about breaking that wall that keeps you separate and safe from a sometimes savage and dangerous world, and letting another person in ultimately is a terrifying act.
Especially when you're just meeting the person and you don't really know who they are. And, in a metaphorical way, it's done in True Blood because the main female character is telepathic. She can read people's minds, but not the mind of the vampire that she's falling in love with. And so in this character, she's meeting this vampire and not really sure, like, is he good or evil or a combination of both, or can she trust him or not?
But at the same time, she can relax and just be herself without putting up this guard that she has to work at.
Yes, she guards against other people because reading their minds,
she doesn't want to hear other
really
people's
complicates
thoughts.
Things. Yes, they're usually not good thoughts.
And it's a really sort of seductive space for her to just relax like that.
My guess is Alan Ball and his new series True Bloods about vampires who come out of their graves because synthetic blood is now available, so they no longer have to feed on humans. Did you grow up with any vampire movies or books?
When I was a kid, Dark Shadows started airing, and me and some of the neighborhood kids would rush home from school so that we could be there when it started. And when that organ music came on, or whatever the music was, it was kind of spooky, and there were shots of waves crashing against rocks. We would hold our necks like we couldn't breathe while the music was on. And then once the music was over, we'd leave and go outside and play because the show itself was kind of boring to us. But that was I knew what vampires were, but I've never really... I'm not what one would call a vampire aficionado. I don't really, I haven't read a lot of the popular vampire fiction. There are movies and television shows I've never even seen.
Have you seen the Bela Lugosi Dracula or?
Yes, of course I've seen that.
Nosferatu, the Klaus Kinski Nosferatu.
I have seen the Klaus Kinski Nosferatu.
In the Klaus Kinski Nosferatu, there's so much brooding about the curse of eternal life. People think they'd love to leave it eternally, but if you ask the Klaus Kinski Nosferatu, he would see it as a curse.
Yeah, I would imagine that there is a curse aspect to it, because if you live forever, then why is this day important? You lose everything. Everything you have, you lose eventually, unless there are other vampires and... I don't know. I just feel like the finite nature of life is kind of what makes it important.
You had to think a lot about blood in making this, both how you wanted, like what kind of stage blood you wanted to use, what color it should be, what thickness it should be.
Right.
You had to think about how it should taste to people. So what kind of things did you do blood-wise to prepare for making True Blood?
Well, in the world of True Blood, there is human blood and there's vampire blood. Human blood is the blood that flows through all of our veins. It's the same color. It's the same thickness. It's the same viscosity. Vampire blood is a highly volatile organic substance that, when ingested by humans, can have aphrodisiac qualities. It can have increased strength, increased senses as a byproduct. It can also be hallucinogenic. It can be a doorway into other perceptions. And so we wanted to make that very different and very sort of really decadent. So we made it darker and thicker. It's almost like molasses, and it's a really dark brownish red. As far as what it tastes like, I never really even thought of that. We certainly have – I just let the actors act, you know, how they seem to enjoy it when they start drinking it. And we have dialogue referring to how True Blood, the synthetic blood, is a poor substitute for refined vampire palates.
We're listening to an interview with Alan Ball, who created the HBO series True Blood. It's about vampires who want to rejoin society and live among the living. Here's a scene from the first episode. Anna Paquin plays a waitress in a small Louisiana town where many of the vampires reside. A handsome and mysterious stranger has walked in, and she's ready to take his order.
Hi, what can I get for you tonight?
Do you have any of that synthetic bottled blood?
No, I'm so sorry. Sam got some a year ago, but nobody ever ordered it, so it went bad. You're our first vampire.
Am I that obvious?
I knew the minute you came in. Can't believe nobody else around here seems to.
He does.
Oh, don't worry about Sam. He's cool. I know for a fact he supports a vampire rights amendment.
How progressive of him.
Well, anything else? You drink?
Actually, no. But you can get me a glass of red wine so I have a reason to be here.
Well, whatever the reason, I'm glad you are.
I'd love to hear what casting was like, how people showed up. Especially like for the lead vampire role, the role that Steve Moyer plays. Like, how do people show up for the role? Were they wearing what they thought would be appropriate?
Yeah. A lot of people came in wearing all black. You know, I've learned now that I've done a season of the show. You know, you got to be careful when you give an actor fangs because their tendency is to go mad immediately and start doing vampire acting. Which I really wanted to avoid. I didn't want to have any of those strange contact lenses that like come into, you know, that all of a sudden their eyes change when their fangs come out, or there's any sort of prosthesis change in their facial structure. I just wanted to give them fangs and let them act. It was a really hard role to cast. We saw a lot of men. There were people that I took to the network that the network was not crazy about. There were people the network wanted to see that I was not crazy about. And then Stephen, I saw off a video that a casting director in London had made, and I watched it in a little, tiny little postage stamp size video on my computer. And there was something so, for lack of a better word, real about him and this sort of world-weary but tragic feeling that he brought to it, aside from being really, really handsome, which helps.
In a worn-out way.
Yeah, exactly. Like he's been through through hell. And there's actually a great line in one of the episodes where Sookie says, "How old are you?" And he said, "I was 30 human years when I was made vampire." And she goes, "Wow, you look older than that." And he says, "Well, life was harder then." But he really brought, for me, what he brings to the role is the sense of it's tragic. It's tragic what happened to him. He did not ask to be made vampire. He lost his family and his children. He lost his life. And now he's condemned to wandering the world at night, not being a part of the world that he was so much a part of before he was made vampire, before he went off to fight in the Civil War. So we brought Stephen over. And I worked with him for a day, and then we went into HBO, and it became very obvious very fast that this was the guy we'd been waiting for.
So did he not dress in all black for the audition?
You know, he wore jeans and like a blazer.
No chains or anything?
No, he didn't come in all black, and he didn't come in with, you know, the sort of extreme eyebrows and that kind of thing. And I like that about him because I like I want Bill to, you know, just be a guy who is a vampire.
You said you wanted to just give your actors fangs and let them act. And so talk about the fangs.
Well, in keeping with our idea about the supernatural being a deeper, more profound manifestation of nature, we really thought a lot about the physiology of the fangs. And we created fangs that actually lie flat along the roof of the mouth and then click into place when a vampire is in danger or aroused or ready to feed, much like a rattlesnake's fangs click into place. And we actually created a model of teeth with showing how the fangs click in and click out. And then we put the fangs not on the not with the four front teeth between them, but with only two because it worked better for the physiology of the rattlesnake, the snake fang working. And I like that because it looks a little different. It doesn't look like the classic thing. And I like the fact that it's not just like this supernatural teeth morph into fangs, you know. It's actually part of their physiology. And there's a sound they make when they click, which is kind of like a weapon being loaded. So it really works. It helps, you know, it works well for the show in that regard, I think.
Did you have to work with a dentist in order to get them made?
Oh, yeah. Everybody. And even when we cast, you know, guest vampire for one episode, they have to go off and get impressions made of their teeth and they make fangs. And it's hilarious to watch the dailies because the actors will, like, make a face and then we'll stop and everybody will go get their little plastic cup with their fangs and put their fangs in and, you know, make sure they're fit. And then the scene keeps going.
So can the actors activate the fangs by pressing a button in their mouth?
No. They have to. That has to be done with visual effects. The fangs are just the actual fangs that they place on their teeth once they've extended. But the extending and the retracting of fangs we have to do as a visual effect, and we have to put little dots on the actor's face as tracking marks.
I see.
So if you ever watch an unfinished cut of our show, there's some unintentional humor in those moments.
So we talked a little bit about casting Stephen Moyer as the lead vampire. Mm-hmm. Anna Paquin plays a waitress who is telepathic and starts to fall in love with the vampire and he with her, or at least that's the way it's looking. Talk about why you cast her. People will probably know her from The Piano.
And the X-Men movies.
And the X-Men movies, yeah. And The Piano, she was like, what are you...
11.
Yeah, she was really young.
Yeah. When I heard that Anna wanted to come in and read for Sookie, I was surprised. I thought, well, why does she want to do this? She's a movie star. But she aggressively pursued it. And then I thought about it and I thought, well, it makes perfect sense. It's a great role. It's the lead of the show. She's sexy and she's a romantic heroine and she's strong and she's, you know, she gets to play the gamut of human emotion and also have all these great chase scenes and fight sequences, and it actually makes perfect sense to me. And I wasn't too sold on the idea at first because Sookie is described in the books as being blonde and blue-eyed, and I had only known Anna with dark hair, which is her natural hair color. But, you know, once she came in and she started reading and I started working with her, what she was playing and what I really thought made the character really interesting was I could see that this is a woman who had been hearing other people's thoughts her entire life and that she was kind of skittish and nervous and jumpy and a little angry. And it kept her from being, you know, a lot of girls came in and they were like sorority girls. You know, they overdid the Southern accent or they sort of came in dressed like Daisy May. And I was like, no. And the character just came alive in a way with Anna that was the most interesting. And so that's who we cast. Because I always feel like I don't – you know, I will have a clear idea of what I think a character looks like when I write it. But the minute I start going into casting, I let it go because you don't want to – you want to be open to people coming in and doing different interpretations because sometimes those interpretations are going to be better. And they're going to work better, and they're going to make the character live more.
Well, Ellen Ball, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I really love talking to you. Let's do it again.
Alan Ball speaking with Terry Gross. The second season of Ball's series True Blood premieres June 14th on HBO. The DVD of the first season will be out later this month. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies filling in for Terry Gross. Tomorrow is National Train Day, and a good time for us to remember a uniformed cadre of railmen who defined a period of American train travel and became an agent of social change, the Pullman Porters. They got their name from George Pullman, who started a train company in the 1860s that had sleeping cars and promised luxury travel. The passengers were assured of special treatment by the Pullman Porters. Pullman intentionally hired black men for the job, which was exhausting and sometimes demeaning, but also one of the best available to African-American men. In fact, the Pullman Porters helped create and enlarge the black middle class. The Pullman Company terminated its sleeping car service in the late 1960s. Journalist Larry Tye's book about the Porters is called Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. Terry spoke to him in 2004.
You write that by the 1960s, Pullman Porters had come to personify the grinning servant, the Uncle Tom, but the Pullman Porters had been real agents of social change in their prime. In what ways did they help create social change?
In a couple ways. They first started in the 1930s. They launched the first successful black trade union in America. And this was a union that did all the conventional things that a union does in terms of giving them substantially more wages, shorter working hours, general better working conditions. But much more important than that, it gave them a sense of self-respect and a sense of identity that they weren't just these nameless, faceless guys who worked on the cars. They actually gave them name badges, which were very important things for these men who had either been called George or been called by conventional profanities over their years on the Pullman cars. And they were called George because in the tradition of a slave being named after a slave master, they were seen as the servants of George Pullman, the man who launched the company they worked for.
George Pullman started hiring Pullman porters shortly after the end of slavery, and he intentionally wanted to hire dark-skinned ex-slaves. What was his reasoning?
His reasoning was twofold. One, it was that they would come and work for him for whatever price, however low the price he decided to pay them, and he paid them next to nothing, and that they would work as long and as hard as he would demand of them, and he demanded them working 100 or more hours a week. But the more interesting reason that he hired them was he was trying to sell railroad customers back then on a whole new concept, on the concept of overnight travel. And his sleeping cars were more than double the price of a conventional railroad ticket. So he had to convince these passengers that they were going to get such ultimate service, such luxurious service, that it was worth paying this what seemed like an extremely high fee. And who better to convince them that they were going to be waited on brilliantly than ex-slaves who embodied for these white passengers the whole notion of service.
What was the service that they were asked to provide?
They were asked to do everything from serve as a chambermaid to a valet, shining shoes, nursing hangovers, taking care of passengers who were drunk or who had lost their temper. They were basically asked to do everything that somebody would do in a hotel on the entire service staff. And they were the only service staff on this railroad trip across country that could often take 3 or 4 days. So they did every job that was asked them.
Now, you mentioned that there was another reason why George Pullman wanted to hire dark-skinned African-Americans, and that was to clearly differentiate between the porters and the passengers, because these were sleeper cars. People were going to be undressing, preparing for bed. What was his reasoning there?
There was a sense of the social separation, that these should be men who were so clearly from a different world than his white passengers that nobody could ever see themselves as running into these guys in another situation off the train. And the blackness of their skin was seen as one more way to differentiate them from their white passengers and to say, these are people who are different. They are almost invisible to you, and you should not worry that you would ever be embarrassed if you're in a compromising position with them on the train in terms of ever having to see them again in your other life.
There was a whole rule book that he published regulating the porters' interactions with their passengers. What were some of the things in the rule book?
There were some extraordinary things in the rule book. Some of the things that I found most interesting and were most offensive to the Pullman porters were that they should use different colored blankets than either the passengers or the white conductors to make sure that no white employee of George Pullman or no white who rode on his train should ever have to worry about using the same pillow or blanket that a black porter had used. There were rules governing everything from how to fold a sheet to how to swat a fly, that everything, George Pullman believed in a system of management that didn't leave any detail to the discretion of his employees generally, and particularly to his black Pullman porters. So he specified how they should dust the passenger's jacket when they were leaving the train, on exactly what they should do in shining shoes. Every little detail was written down in his hundreds of rules, in his thick rule book that every porter was required to carry every moment that they were on the train.
Do you think that African Americans in the late 1800s and early 1900s considered this a good job?
It was actually considered one of the two best jobs you could have in the black community back then, particularly for a black man. They used to say, there was a wonderful expression, Pullman and postal were the best things that a black man in that era could do, and it meant that working for the post office was one of the best jobs in terms of having higher pay and having a job with more status. And the only thing that beat that in terms of blue-collar work in the black world back then was being a Pullman porter.
What was the life like, the day-to-day life of a Pullman porter?
The day-to-day life was one of having to largely wear a mask that essentially allowed them to accept some of the humiliation, some of the abuse that they took from their passengers, and not give it back to them. They lived, in a sense, in two different worlds. One was a world that they showed and the face that they showed to their white passengers, and that was a perpetually obliging one. And the other was a world that they live in with fellow Pullman porters, where they actually develop their own language and their own way of learning how to absorb this abuse without giving it back, that gave them very much of a schizophrenic world back then.
Where did they sleep?
They slept in the smoking room, which doubled as the men's toilet, that they had a little curtain that separated them from the toilets and the wash basins, and they had an old couch back there, and they were given at most 4 hours to sleep at night. Now, in fact, that sleep was interrupted any time a white passenger, a white man, came in to use the toilet or to have a poker game into the late night in the smoking room or just to have a smoke. And so it was 4 hours maximum sleep, perpetual interruptions, and a very uncomfortable old couch separated by a thin curtain that was where they were supposed to get enough sleep to function for their 100 hours of work a month.
Must have been hard to function and hard to be cheerful with so little sleep.
A little hard to be both of those, absolutely. And yet these guys managed to do it for careers that spanned 30 and 40 years, which was a function of two things, of how few other choices they had and of how the upside of the job, the idea of being able to travel the country, being able to absorb lessons from their wealthy and interesting white passengers, that all of that looked so good compared to what other choices they had in those days, that they were willing to absorb the downsides of the job for all those years.
What impact do you think it had on the porters and on the families of the porters for them to be exposed to the travel and to so many different people?
We can see directly, that's a big piece of this book in terms of trying to understand how they absorbed those lessons and what role it played in their lives. They came to see the value of education. Their white passengers perpetually talked to them about the importance of getting advanced degrees or going to college at all, and they learned those lessons and saw that the kids could get schooling. They learned how to invest the money that they made, and it started out as very little money, but after they had a union, they had enough to actually think about what they would invest it in, and they saw America's leading financiers riding the train with them, and these are people they spent 3 and 4 days with, and they learned really concrete lessons. One porter after another would tell me the great investments they made, which in many cases let them get off the railroads or at a minimum let them put their kids through school. They absorbed the whole lesson of how the white world worked in ways that they went on to put into use in their own life and that let them become, if not themselves, through their children and grandchildren, the founding members of the black middle class.
How did the Pullman Porter start to unionize?
They tried to unionize originally in the late 1800s, and every attempt to unionize was quashed. George Pullman had a monopoly on sleeping car service. He despised the notion of unions, whether they were white unions or black unions, and he managed to fire workers or do anything he had to do to intimidate them. But there was a slow process. It began in the mid-1920s, where a guy named A. Philip Randolph, who was not a Pullman porter, came in and began a process of unionizing them, and it took a full 12 years from the day they started the process to the day they actually got a union to make this effort work. And Randolph and all of his lieutenants went through dire poverty, experienced brutality at the hands of the Pullman Company, and they were never discouraged enough that they one way or another managed to keep fighting the battle, whether it was in the courts, whether it was through regulatory agencies, and most importantly, trying to keep the Pullman porters on board with him. And he miraculously succeeded in doing it through this long 12-year effort.
What are some of the specific things that the Pullman Company tried to do to discourage the African-American workers from unionizing?
They hired thugs, and this came out in a court case, to beat up one of Randolph's top lieutenants. They fired dozens, and some people say hundreds, of Pullman porters who were involved with the union effort. They went to court and did everything they could to quash every effort there. They tried to lobby Congress and successfully did that to pass laws that made it very difficult to unionize the porters. And they did all these things over a consistent period of 12 years, led at one point by Abe Lincoln's son, who took over for George Pullman as the head of the Pullman Company, Robert Todd Lincoln. And he was one of the best union busters of anybody the Pullman Company had ever had on board.
Hmm. Once the Pullman porters did unionize, what impact did that have on the labor movement?
It had two impacts in the labor movement. One is it helped to desegregate the labor movement. In the early days, Randolph, A. Philip Randolph, and his porters union were the only black union who was affiliated. They were not a formal part of the AFL, but they were an affiliated union. And Randolph kept pushing for full status, equal status within the AFL hierarchy. He would go to every executive committee meeting and push for all the black unionists to get more equal treatment. And he was a perpetual thorn in the side of everybody who ran the AFL-CIO for about 25 years until he started seeing his efforts yield some results. It had a profound psychological effect on blacks who were trying to unionize to see as visible a workers as the Pullman porters were, successfully create their own union, and then he yielded practical results by pushing the union movement to accept blacks on an equal basis.
You know, it's still registering on me that President Lincoln's son became the head of the Pullman Company and was so anti-union. Is it going too far to say that Lincoln signed the proclamation to free the slaves and then his son made sure that some of those ex-slaves or descendants of slaves didn't make a lot of money?
Actually, the Pullman porters over the years had their own expression. Lincoln freed the slaves and his son re-enslaved them, and they didn't feel it was going too far to say that, and that's precisely what Robert Todd Lincoln did. He was as vehement as George Pullman had ever been in terms of trying to limit salaries, limit any potential for promotion, basically limit the opportunities for his Pullman porters and keep them as chattel slaves. And I think that Pullman porters over the years found that a really grim but ironic situation they were perpetually pointing to.
Do you think that the Pullman porters or their union had much of an influence on the civil rights movement?
I think they had a profound influence. If I can tell you a quick story about when we think of the beginning of the civil rights movement, we often date it from the Montgomery bus boycott. And the Montgomery bus boycott began when Rosa Parks was asked to step to the back of the bus, refused to do it, and was arrested. The first person that she summoned to the jail to bail her out of jail was a Pullman porter named Edgar D. Nixon. She knew Nixon because she worked for him. He had an office that he held two hats in that office, and one was as head of the local chapter of the NAACP. The other was as head of the local chapter of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And Nixon had been waiting for years to have just the right test case to try this boycott of the Montgomery bus system. He had one problem, though, in trying to organize this boycott, and that was that he was a Pullman porter who was out on the road so much that he couldn't be there to be at all the meetings. So he looked around town for who would be somebody that could be the perfect front man for him in this boycott. And he saw this young minister who had just graduated from Boston University named Martin Luther King, who happened to have the biggest church in town. And he saw King as perfect. He represented a wealthy church, a large church, and he was young and impressionable enough that Nixon could pull the strings in making this boycott happen with Martin King as the front man to start with. And I think that's an interesting story to me because it's a metaphor for what Porters did throughout the years in the civil rights movement, that they used their union halls, turned over their union halls for civil rights meetings. They bankrolled the civil rights movement at a time when there was no money to support civil rights activities. And their people behind the scenes were critical actors from the earliest days of the civil rights movement.
As part of your research for this book, you found as many surviving Pullman porters, former Pullman porters that you could, and tried to interview them. You also interviewed family members of former Pullman porters. How did you find these people?
I had been a journalist for 20 years, and the most difficult job I think I've ever done in those 20 years was finding these Pullman porters. I did everything that I called on every trick and every convention that I'd learned during those years as being a journalist, from putting ads in railroad retirement magazines, putting ads in every black newspaper in every railroad city in America. I had Amtrak helping me track them down. I found their old employment data that was left behind by the Pullman Company and tried to track them down. That way, I wrote letters to probably 500 Pullman workers from those old Pullman Company records. I talked to black ministers in major cities across the country. I talked to civil rights leaders. And those things yielded precious few porters. The technique that actually worked the best, and it shouldn't be surprising, but it surprised me, and I was late to come to it, was talking to people who ran nursing homes in cities, in major cities across the country. And they tended to know the Pullman porters were out of the normal network of social interaction. They were so old and so tuned out from the normal networks. They were in their late 80s, in their 90s. One was 102. And the people who knew who they were and where they were people who were running the nursing homes that they were living in. And in every city, once you found one Pullman porter, they would generally be able to lead you to others. But finding that first one was a wonderful challenge, and I ended up coming up with dozens of them, but it was really difficult and a real challenge.
Now, Pullman porters have figured into a lot of movies, even songs. Do you have any favorites of all the ones you poured through?
First of all, I found fascinating the way the porters were always background characters in the movies. It wasn't a movie from the Thin Man movies to an entire era of movies from the 1920s to about the 1950s where there was a train that you didn't see this obliging, smiling Pullman porter character who generally had no speaking part in the movie. And they were the perfect backdrop, partly because they conjured up this whole era of elegance. And when they said things, it was generally roles as the compliant, obliging fool. But I think that there were a bunch of authors who managed to go a little deeper, and one of them, and my favorite, was Studs Terkel. And he had interviewed E.D. Nixon, this guy who brought Martin Luther King into the civil rights movement, in an oral history that Terkel was doing of the Great Depression. And he quotes Nixon as saying, "A Pullman porter can always get into a conversation anywhere. He walked into a barber shop, somebody would say, 'I didn't see you around here.' Or maybe they'd notice his pants with a stripe. Everybody listened because they knowed the Pullman porter been everywhere and they never been anywhere themselves." These were men in the black community who stood out and who were seen as the most prominent and respected men in that world. They had been everywhere, they had seen things nobody else had, and they shared their experiences when they came back from every train trip.
Well, Larry Tye, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Larry Tye speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. Tye's book is Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. Live Long and Prosper, Beam Me Up, Scotty, The Final Frontier, Vulcan Mind Meld. Phrases and ideas from the 60s TV series Star Trek populate our language and culture. Now there's a new big-budget Hollywood film that goes back to the beginning, when the crew of the Starship Enterprise first meet. Called simply Star Trek, it's directed by J.J. Abrams, creator of TV's Lost. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The first generation of Star Trek actors is old or gone to the most final of frontiers, the so-called next generation, up in years. And people barely recall the generations after that. So Paramount, eager to relaunch their franchise, tapped director J.J. Abrams for a new incarnation. The ad said, "Forget what you know." And Trekkies were incensed. Forget what we know? What we know is the point. Has Abrams dared to take Gene Roddenberry's sacred universe, fount of 5 TV shows and 10 movies and thousands of geek conventions, and change it? Yes and no. They change it a little. Abrams' Star Trek features old characters, Kirk, Spock, McCoy, Scotty, Uhura, Sulu, Chekhov, at a young age, students in Starfleet Academy. But there's a key difference, thanks to a black hole. You know what happens when you travel through a black hole in a sci-fi picture, right? You go back in time. You change history. Trek opens with a smashing prologue in which a ship from the future hurtles through a black hole with a vengeful Romulan called Nero, played by Eric Bana. I won't tell you why he's angry. That's explained later in the film. But before you can say, "Lock on photon torpedoes," the Trek we know is changed. Kirk's father is killed moments after Kirk is born, so our hero, played by Chris Pine, grows up a fatherless ne'er-do-well. He doesn't want to be on a starship, much less captain one, until he's shamed by his father's contemporary, Pike, played by Bruce Greenwood.
Enlist in Starfleet.
You guys must be way down on your recruiting quota for the month.
Now, if you're half the man your father was, Jim, Starfleet could use you. You can be an officer in 4 years. You can have your own ship in 8. You understand what the Federation is, don't you? It's important. It's a peacekeeping and humanitarian armada.
We done?
I'm done. Riverside Shipyard. Shuttle for new recruits leaves tomorrow, 0800. Your father was captain of a starship for 12 minutes.
He saved 800 lives, including your mother's and yours.
I dare you to do better.
A peacekeeping and humanitarian armada. Who could resist that? It's no surprise Kirk shows up for that shuttle, where he meets disheveled hipster Dr. McCoy, played by Carl Urban, who's funny even if he talks like Owen Wilson. But the biggest change is between Kirk and Spock. They loathe each other on sight. They're antagonists. We're on Kirk's side, though. Chris Pine mugs like mad, but he seizes the space with a likable impudence, as if both channeling and poking fun at William Shatner. On the other hand, Zachary Quinto is hard to like. His Spock is a know-it-all. Even geeks would slam into a locker. There's an issue larger than Quinto's lack of charisma. Do we want Kirk and Spock at odds instead of with that symbiotic rapport of the TV show, where the point was to watch Kirk, virile man of action, navigate between Spock's cool logic and McCoy's passionate humanism? If you care about this universe, and I do, you'll argue with this Trek at every turn. But you can nitpick it to death and still adore it. I mean, it's Star Trek. The action is furious, the banter bright. The real suspense isn't whether the crew can take down the villain Nero, who turns out to be quite a dull fellow. It's whether Kirk and Spock will be friends as before, and Kirk will captain the Enterprise. Yes, we want it different, but also the same. A time travel conundrum worthy of Star Trek itself. The actors show tons of promise, even if they're sometimes like baby Looney Tunes doing familiar shtick in high voices. Zoe Saldana is a knockout as Uhura, and it's great to see Simon Pegg, Shaun of the Dead, as Scotty, and John Cho, Harold of Harold and Kumar, as Sulu. Best of all, Leonard Nimoy's Spock comes through that black hole, too. He looks very old, but happier than he has in years. When he meets Quinto as his younger self and suggests being less of a prig, there's a wonderful subtext. "I am entrusting you with Spock," he seems to say. "Cherish him and let the franchise live long and prosper."
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.